Okay, the next argued case this morning is number 21-1939, Immunogen Incorporated against Hirschfeld as acting director of the PTO. Mr. Jaffrey.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'd like to discuss both indefiniteness and obviousness, but let me start with obviousness because the office is currently using the district court's decision to reject other applications. The district court held that the claim was obvious on summary judgment, despite the fact that no one had even recognized the problem of mirvetuximab causing ocular toxicity in humans. No one had ever used AIBW dosing before with any ADC, much less to solve that ocular toxicity problem. And when trying to deal with ocular toxicities with other drugs, scientists had changed other things. They had never used AIBW. And indeed, the office's own expert admitted that 6 milligrams per kilogram of a patient's adjusted ideal body weight, AIBW, was not obvious. And the office really doesn't disagree with that. Rather, it states on page 2 of its brief, the particular dose of 6 milligrams per kilogram would have been discovered. But the standard for obviousness is not would have been discovered. And at a bare minimum, there were factual determinations that should not have been resolved against Immunogen. The office's obviousness argument hinges upon the Lutz 282 reference. But that reference only highlights why Immunogen's application is not obvious.
Mr. Jaffe, can I ask you, are you seeking reversal with your first argument? Is that your suggestion, as opposed to a vacate and remand?
We would only suggest that you vacate and remand
because there was no cross motion for summary.
There was no cross motion, and this is just purely an incorrect summary determination against my client.
So really all you need to show is that there's genuine issues of material fact?
Exactly right.
Okay.
And there are more than a lot. And specifically, if we look at the Lutz 282, that reference alone is the one that shows why Immunogen's application is not obvious. The office uses Lutz 282 as its primary reference, but Immunogen tried to use the doses in Lutz 282, and Lutz 282 said in its own words that it had solved the problem of ocular toxicity in rabbits. But when Immunogen tried to use that prior reference, you tried to use those doses, it failed. So there cannot be any reason to think that a reference that you try to use fail and then come up with a different solution that actually works means that the new solution is obvious in light of those failed attempts. So it is only due to the precise use of this 6 milligrams of AIBW dosing that solved the problem of ocular toxicity and none other. So now if I could direct the court's attention to indefiniteness. District court's fundamental error in this regard is that it explicitly declined to understand or consider how a person of skill in the art would read the patent. Every single one of the experts in this case agreed that the formula that you use in order to determine a patient's adjusted ideal body weight is drug specific. There is only one formula for AIBW that would actually work for mirvetuximab, and it is experimentally determined. And that comes straight out of their own expert's mouth. Dr. Figg stated in discussing what AIBW formula would have been used by a person of skill in the art. He said, in the response to the question, you had said that there's different correction factors for the AIBW calculation, right? Correct. And that is drug specific, right? Answer, correct. Would it have been obvious to use the specific value of 0.4 given in the 809 application when dosing mirvetuximab? Answer, no. And the reason you didn't know that is because you needed the data. Answer, correct. So at the end of the day, there is no confusion among people of skill in the art which formula to use. It's the very formula that is found throughout Immunogen's application.
Help me with that, just a background dumb question. Why is it so that there's only one AIBW for any particular pharmaceutical?
Because the AIBW formula is based upon how much adipose tissue, how much fat you have in your body. And so the more fat that you have in the body, the less likely the drug can move around freely to everywhere that it needs to go. And so,
why is it specific for the drug? Like, for example, you know, in patent law, we have the concept that, you know, if something could infringe, or the claim doesn't have to be perfect. Something could infringe even if it's not as perfect as what's in the specification. So why couldn't you have various different formulas? I mean, I think that's one of the arguments, is that there's various different ways to calculate the ideal body weight. So why do you have to just be limited to the one in the specification?
There's several reasons for that, Your Honor. First, that's their own expert, Dr. Figg, admitted that AIBW formulas are drug-specific. You have to actually do these things experimentally. You can't just sort of a priori determine what AIBW formula to use without knowing which drug you're using and what application you're using it for, which are clearly spelled out in the claim.
So in your specification, you identified the one that goes with this particular drug in the claim.
Exactly. And it's all found in example 4 of that, of the application.
Yeah, I understood the point, but I just didn't understand why. I mean, I understand why you couldn't say, I got this drug and I got this drug. Why wouldn't the same, it's, each one has its own formula. The formula could be the same.
No, well, the evidence is that they're not, because different drugs go through your fat and sit in your adipose tissue in different ways. Moreover, they're not, because this is all experimentally determined, because ocular toxicity is extremely unpredictable. People just don't know ahead of time what amounts of drugs are going to cause you to have blurry vision and ocular toxicity events. And so you have to determine that, what number is, experimentally, which is what the inventors did. They're the first ones to ever determine, let's use this AIBW formula and then figure out, oh, if we use the specific milligrams per kilogram of a patient's AIBW using this formula, we have decoupled the effect of ocular toxicity, the side effects, from the effectiveness of the therapy.
Well, you find the right amount of AIBW by testing and then looking to see if there are adverse effects, and then simply adjusting up and down?
Not quite, Your Honor, because there's two things that are going on. First, you have to try to find the right formula that allows for there not to be a lot of side effects. But then the second step of it is you have to still ensure that you are actually treating the cancer. So it's those two things that you have to juggle. And that's, it could well have been the case that there was no formula and that there was no amount that could have done both things, which is to reduce ocular toxicity, but still treat the platinum-resistant ovarian cancer.
Is this a particular problem for immunotherapy for cancers, or does it affect blood pressure and all sorts of other diseases?
This is a particular problem for these antibody drug conjugates that take the antibody and link it up with a toxic drug using a charge linker. There's been only something like 6 ADCs that have ever been approved by the FDA, because most of them turn out to be unacceptably toxic.
This is a targeted technology.
Exactly. And so the fact that the inventors came up with this solution at all is shocking, because normally you'd expect the more drug you give somebody, the more likely it's going to work, but also the more likely that it's going to have bad side effects. And they were able to, using this very specific formula, able to decouple those two things. And so that's why...
I don't want to use up your argument, but I'm just curious about the background.
Yeah, no, it
Satis, I'm a history major, so I need help once in a while. You can talk about the Renaissance and the Reformation all you want, but...
I probably won't go there in this argument, Your Honor, but the point, though, is that there were specific factual findings that would have made it clear that that AIBW in the immunogen application is only that one that is actually printed there in Hyverba. And that's both the fact that their own expert admits that the AIBW formula is drug specific. There's only one. But also remember, this was prosecuted before the office. So the office had never raised at any given point that the examiner never said, I don't understand which AIBW formula you're using. He was perfectly clear about which formula to use. The applicant was quite clear that the AIBW formula was the one that was in the specification. The board itself had no problem understanding. At no point before the agency when we could have amended our claims and said, all right, if you don't understand what AIBW means, which we think you do, it's actually, let's just put that formula right into the claims. No point did they do that. It was only after, once they were sued in district court under Section 145, that they raised for the first time, we don't understand what you mean by this term. That background, that prosecution history, should have been looked at and considered at a bare minimum by the district court in coming to the conclusion about whether the term AIBW was actually indefinite or not. And this court's case law strongly supports that at a bare minimum, the district court ought to consider what arguments had been made previously before the office.
On this issue, are you looking for a vacate and remand on the indefiniteness issue, or is because indefiniteness is an ultimate legal question, do you think reversal is appropriate? And with that comes, you know, you're telling us we should be looking at expert testimony.
Yes.
And which raises factual issues.
I agree. So that's why we only suggest vacater and remand, so that the board can properly consider the expert testimony, which was all in line and all of accord and said that AIBW meant one specific thing. And so as to the question of whether or not, Judge Stoll, that there are two grounds, the problem that we're facing is that the obviousness determination is being used preclusively on other immunogen applications. So there are other immunogen applications out there that are being found to be obvious based upon issue preclusion. And so we would ask that this court vacate the obviousness determination too, besides, obviously, regardless of what this court determines as regarding
the definition. You've alleged that you think there's a lot of genuine issues of material fact. Do you want to list what those are?
In
your briefs on the
there are numerous. So the district court made just many, many findings of fact in its opinion. At A29, it states the prior art teaches every individual element of the asserted claims. That's a finding of fact. District court said at A30, for many patients, dosing by total body weight and dosing by AIBW would not result in significant differences. Another finding of fact. A poster would have been motivated to investigate dosing methodologies such as AIBW, A31, another finding of fact. Ocular toxicity of mirvetuximab would have been known as a result of human testing, A31, another finding of fact. I could keep going on and on.
And these are facts that you contend.
Every single one of those are contested. Exactly. Every one of those is contested. Many of those are not only contested, but they're wrong based upon the office's own expert saying the contrary. IFC, I'm into my rebuttal time. I will reserve the rest of it.
Anything else at the moment? Okay, we'll save your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Daniel Kasman on behalf of the USPTO. I guess I'll start with obviousness because Mr. Joffrey focused on that. I think it's important to recognize here what Lutz teaches. Lutz teaches doses of 6 milligrams per kilogram of the claimed immunoconjugate based on total body weight. It should be undisputed, I think it is undisputed, that for a patient who's at their ideal body weight, there is no difference between adjusted ideal body weight and total body weight. The reason, if you look at the formula, is that the weight in kilograms minus IBW is zero, so adjusted ideal body weight is the same thing as ideal body weight, which is the same thing as total body weight. Basically, if they get their claim, you cannot dose a patient who's at their ideal body weight at 6 milligrams per kilogram, even though that's exactly what Lutz is telling you to do. So they're going to preempt you from practicing the prior art.
Is this an obviousness argument?
It is, because Lutz doesn't say just 6 milligrams. It teaches ranges right around. So if you look at Lutz, it's got doses about 5 to 6, about 6 to 8, but they're all centered around the 6 milligrams. So it's not an anticipation because we only have ranges in Lutz.
Don't the claims say that you've got to provide the dose based on idealized body weight?
They have never argued that you only infringe if you mentally calculate the dose using a certain formula. They've always said it's based on the ultimate formula. And, you know, there might be issues with...
I mean, your argument sounds like an infringement argument. It doesn't sound like an obviousness argument. It sounds like you're concerned that they're going to preempt the field, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't really sound like obviousness to me.
But isn't that which infringes later is anticipated or obvious? In this case, it's a ring.
Why don't we talk about what the prior art teaches and stick to the subject at hand here, which
sure.
is whether there's genuine issues of material fact. For example, on motivation to combine. Whether there's a motivation to combine, which is, you know, a very important factor in an obviousness analysis, that's a fact question.
That is a fact question, but you only need to combine things. If we start with the LUTs on its own, just if you look at, if there's no difference for patients at their ideal body weight between the types of dosing, then actually the 6 milligrams per kilogram and there's nothing to combine. It's all in LUTs. It's just the specific point of within the ranges that LUTs is focusing on six, saying that 6 milligrams per kilogram is LUTs. There's no dispute that there is, you don't need AIBW dosing. If there's no difference between AIBW dosing or total body weight dosing or ideal body weight dosing, they're all the same for a patient at their ideal body weight. That's the first problem.
What about a scenario where it's not an ideal body weight? So your obviousness argument only applies in a situation for where the patient's already at their ideal body weight.
We have two arguments. The first argument is that their claim is broad enough to cover patients at their ideal body weight. And so those patients, you are preventing them from getting the prior art dose, or the dose stressed in the prior art. That's the first argument. And even if you're right near it, then you're right at the dose optimization, because you're right around the central point that Lutz is teaching. That's the first argument. The second argument will require motivation to combine, which is that the prior art, their own prior art, actually says dosing method,
I was just looking at the claim. I'm just having such a hard time with your argument that the claim isn't limited to adjusted ideal body weight.
Well, the claim is a dose. It's not how you calculate. It's the dose that you would get if you used adjusted ideal body weight. But if you meant, like, it can't be that the infringement of the claim depends on how the doctor thinks about what dose to give. Is the ultimate dose 6 milligrams per kilogram of adjusted ideal body weight? If it is, then that should be infringement. And if it isn't, that shouldn't be. It should be the ultimate dose that you're giving. And that already, for a patient at ideal body weight, you'll get there through a different formula. But the prior art's telling you to use that very dose. So unless the claims are construed to require this mental step of how you calculate the dose, that you're going to have to say that it's a claim to a dose, not a claim to calculating a dose that would work out based on adjusted ideal body weight. But it's not how you calculate. The second point is their own prior art tells you it's easy to determine the optimum dosing methodology. And then they follow up with a follow-up patent saying, but we found the optimum dosing methodology, and that actually was not easy and is patentable. That having said that, the prior art already teaches you, an administering physician can easily determine, that's their own words and their own prior art.
Why isn't there a genuine issue of material fact because nobody had ever thought to use this adjusted ideal body weight for an antibody drug conjugate before?
The reason is because the prior art already tells you experiment with dosing methodologies and articles.
Not for an antibody drug conjugate. Why doesn't that create a genuine issue of material fact?
But the prior art about this very antibody drug conjugate says an administering physician can easily determine the optimum dosing methodology. It's about this antibody
drug. And does it say that generically, or does it say that, you know, using this particular technique of using the adjusted ideal body weight?
No, it says just dosing methodology. I'm sorry.
So your view is that because there's a prior art reference that says for antibody drug conjugate,
for this
person of ordinary skill in the art could figure out the dosing.
And the dosing methodology.
And the dosing methodology, that renders obvious this particular dosing methodology.
Yes, because it's one of nine, according to Green, or one of the few standard dosing methodologies. So there are only a few you can use, and you've picked one of them, so then that would render it obvious. So that's the second argument. Again, the first argument is just the dose is the same. So unless you're going to read in a mental step into the claims, then...
In summary judgment, aren't you supposed to make all inferences in favor of the non-movement? Again, their argument is that it's undisputed that nobody has used this methodology before for this class of drug, the antibody drug conjugate. And so their argument is that at a minimum, that raises a genuine issue of material fact on motivation to use this particular technique.
So again,
why wouldn't that inference be in their favor as opposed to in the PTO's favor when the PTO is the movement for summary judgment?
I mean, the inference should be in their favor. I just want to just to reiterate, that's only if you don't go with the first argument, which is that is the dose in the prior art. The fact that you calculate the dose using AIBW doesn't matter because you end up at the same dose. But putting that aside, which to me seems very compelling, that ultimately it's the dose you give the patient that anybody cares about, and it doesn't matter for patients at their ideal body weight how you calculate it. So that's the first argument, which doesn't even involve a motivation to combine. It's that it's just the same thing. But even putting that to the side, once you have a group of nine, like, you know, this court said, for example, with finding the besalate salt in the Pfizer case, for example, it's like, it actually reversed the jury finding, I believe, but maybe a trial court finding. And it said, look, there are 50 salts that people use. And so the fact that you found that the besalate is the one that works with amlodipine, that's just like, it's so obvious to try when there's such a finite number. And that's what KSR tells us, is if there's a finite number of possibilities and there's, you know, easy enough to test, which this is, then that can be obvious even on summary judgment. So that's, I think, where we are. I mean, I can see I'm not persuading you, but.
No, again, it's genuine issue material fact, and your argument seems, and the court's opinion, to be honest, reads as if it's a bench trial. Your argument kind of sounds like a bench trial argument.
So, again, I'm happy to move on. Again, I just want to reiterate, this only gets into the fact, only matters if you don't care about the fact that the doses are the same as the prior art for some patients, just because.
I mean, your view would be that if there's instructions to provide this drug and it says nothing about ideal adjusted body weight, that those instructions would, there'd be induced infringement in a case like that, because it turns out that for some patients, there is no difference.
Yeah, and some patients is not like some concocted patient, like an 8-foot, 20-pound patient. It's actually the person at their ideal body weight. It's actually the sort of, not me, unfortunately, but the standard is that's what you're aiming for in a patient's the ideal body weight. And then I want to just get to indefiniteness briefly. So on indefiniteness, I think the ultimate point here is we have a definition in the specification that tells you that adjusted ideal body weight can be defined in one of a few ways, for example, some formula, and then it says it optionally accounts for frame size. And they're saying all those options, even though that's how they defined it in the definition section, isn't how a person skilled in the art should read the claim. And that's obviously, we believe that if you have a definition section, then a person of ordinary skill in the art would look to the definition section when reading the claim. And the definition section tells you there are options for how you calculate this. And they're saying there are no options. So that to us.
Let's assume for a minute there are options. How many options do you think there are?
Dr. Figg showed that there have been, there are two parts. One is how you define ideal body weight. And I think he cataloged a dozen different formulas for how you do ideal body weight. That some with frame size, some without. Basically, for every height, how tall.
Whether you take account the frame or not, I understand.
Yeah, and then also just specifically the formula.
A dozen.
Huh?
So a dozen?
A dozen there.
The question is a dozen.
And then when you add the adjusted ideal body weight, you have to add a correction factor. And that correction factor can range. So basically, you take the person's ideal body weight and how far they are from that, and you multiply that by some factor. And that factor ranges from 0.3 to 0.7, which is actually quite the range. So between those two facts, you have with ranges, obviously, you in some sense have an infinite number. But anyhow, a lot of options. And so they've never argued that if all those options are available, their claim isn't indefinite. So I think.
There's something very strange to me about this case. That this isn't an infringement action. This is an action in which the office exists for the purpose of guiding inventors towards how to determine the meets and bounds, how to claim the invention. And yet you're telling us, well, it's indefinite, go away, you lose. Isn't there an obligation on the office to guide and lead inventors towards if there's a need to draw boundaries to tell them so?
So actually, that's what
direction?
That's what they did. We are actually on the indefinite.
That's not what you're doing here.
They're saying
you lose. Go away, you lose.
I don't think go away is exactly right. We're telling they filed a continuation, which is what we wanted them to do. In terms of indefiniteness, they filed a continuation, and there the claims say, wherein ideal body weight means this, and adjusted ideal body weight means that, and those claims don't have an indefiniteness problem. So it all works out that the public will have a clearer claim. They're not losing. They can still file those claims. In a 145, you can still file a continuation after the action because the patent hasn't issued yet. So we're actually just trying to clarify the claims of the state. Normally, you would do this in prosecution. That obviously would have been ideal here. But we didn't do it in prosecution. We caught it in district court. We said, just fix these claims, file a continuation, fix the claims. And they did. After oral argument at the district court, they went back, they filed a continuation, and then they, in the claim itself, said very clearly, what do they mean by AIBW? And now we have, not in this case, it's in the continuation, but it'll have the same priority date, and there isn't this indefiniteness problem.
And you invalidated those claims.
Those claims are invalidated for obviousness based on the issue here. So obviously, if you find this obvious, then the indefiniteness problem is one problem. They've resolved that. The obviousness problem is another one that's at issue here and at issue there. And so but if you reverse us here, then they won't have an obviousness. Then we won't reject them for the same obviousness grounds that we used here, right? It's just, so the indefiniteness part, I just want to be clear about what we're doing here is we are trying to help them out, and they've taken that and they've gone to amend their claims.
I don't see where what you're telling us here was really pursued in just the ordinary back and forth during examination to try and guide these inventors towards complying with the law.
So as Your Honor knows, the PTO's position used to be that these 145 actions were just, the record was closed, there were no new arguments, and we preferred that. We went to the Supreme Court on that issue and we lost. So in some sense, 145 is a continuation of prosecution now. It's not our preferred system, but that's the system the Supreme Court has told us to use. This court blessed that in Hyatt v. Kappos, Iancu, I think. And so that's how we're doing it now. So we've now given them a rejection. It's in a 145, but it's still the same thing as basically a rejection during prosecution. They take that back, they file a continuation, and they can fix their claims. And that's, they've said in their brief, candidly, that that's what they've done. So in terms of indefiniteness, we have tried to just do the regular prosecution thing. It just came a little bit later than ideal. But that's the Supreme Court.
Can I ask you something? If it's a continued prosecution, are the statements that they're making to the PTO and to us and to everybody in these briefs about what the formula is for understanding the scope of their claim, are they limited to that?
Their view
is contrary to yours, that it's not just any formula. It's the specific formula that's in their application. So why isn't that something that you can rely on to understand the scope of the claim and not have it be indefinite?
So to us, what this is a prosecution history disclaimer, which is, I think, the legal term that captures, if you say during prosecution exactly what you mean, that will limit the case, the claims. Okay. But this court has said in In re Clark that prosecution history disclaimer doesn't apply while we're still in prosecution. And the reason is, normally, you can't fix the claims at that point. So you either have to absolutely invalidate them, or you have to say it's okay and you put the limitation. But while you're still in prosecution under BRI, it's the same motivation for BRI, there's actually another option. You just go clarify your claims better. And in an ideal world, the way to understand a claim is not to go to what the patent applicant said in a Federal Circuit case, is to see it from the claims or the specification.
But the specification.
Yeah, and so here we have a specification that has a definition.
It's your view and the district court's view that the specification doesn't provide a particular formula.
I think it's even worse than that. It's almost explicit. Like it is explicitly saying optionally. Like it is telling you, it's not just, they've said in the specification, we want multiple formulas to be allowed. So all we ask, and they've done, is go back, put it in the claims, that which formula you mean, and then the problem is solved. And this is otherwise what you would always have, for example, in Nautilus itself, or in any case where somebody comes to you with an indefinite claim, they could say, okay, this is what we mean, and then that disclaimer would apply. But that's not how we do indefinite. Sort of especially during prosecution, we don't let you then just fix it by announcing in the court case. We want it in the claim or in the spec, and that's under BRI the way we would construe claims.
The purpose of BRI is to guide the applicant towards writing adequately narrow claims. That's the only purpose of BRI.
Yes.
Not to invalidate in this elaborate, expensive appeal procedure what is not prosecuted by the office.
But so this is the problem. In our view, this is a problem with Hyatt. But anyway, this is the reality of Hyatt. The Supreme Court's decision is that 145 actions are still part of prosecution. People are raising new arguments, new evidence is coming in. And so all we're trying to do is guide them towards clearer claims. And they took that guidance and they filed a continuation to get clearer claims. So that is the system.
Are you saying correctly that you're the ones that raised indefiniteness for the first time during this 145 action?
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm way past my time. I don't know if anybody has any questions.
Any questions? Any more questions for counsel?
Yep. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay. We have rebuttal, Mr. Jaffe.
Thank you. I'd like to just address two quick points. One is their argument they're making here on obviousness, which is, look, Lutz includes this AIBW formula. That's what he said. They're preempting the field, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That fights their own expert. Quote, and this is on 10043 of the appendix. Quote, question, we all agree no one had actually dosed any ADC at 6 milligrams per kilogram AIBW as of the priority date. Right? Answer, correct. So they're fighting their own expert on this point. Moreover, they're fighting their own interrogatory response. The interrogatory found at A9919. Question, you have not asserted as prior art any document that discloses administering an immunoconjugate at a dose of 6 milligrams per kilogram AIBW. Admitted. So they're turning around on their own admissions for the first time on appeal saying, look, this is actually included in Lutz. It is not.
How do you respond to the argument that there's anticipation here as a matter of law? Because for some particular patients, the actual idealized body weight is the same as their actual body weight, and therefore your claims preempt what's in the prior.
Two answers, Your Honor. First, the PTAB was presented with the examiner with that exact argument. The examiner said, this is inherent anticipation. And the PTAB said no, and this is found at A6760. Said no, there's no inherent anticipation just because Lutz may teach a TBW dosage that might fall within some dosage.
Because I'm not bound by the PTAB, why don't you tell me what your legal argument for why that's incorrect, or tell me how I should interpret your claims so I don't have that argument in my head.
Because it would essentially make inherent anticipation a dead letter. Inherent anticipation requires something necessarily to be present in the prior art in order to anticipate. It has to necessarily be there. What the office is arguing is saying, well, it may not necessarily be there, but it could be there. There could be such a hypothetical person. And so that renders the claim obvious under their view. So the claim is invalid because something might happen. But if claims are invalid because they might happen, for obviousness reasons, then there's no need to go down to the...
Your view is it isn't inherent?
Yes.
Because it's not necessarily so that there's right. A single person out there that would apply to.
Right, exactly. And on top of it, the district court didn't find that. The district court specifically said...
Do your claims cover that scenario, assuming it existed?
In order to come up with that scenario, you have to use the formulas that are in Immunogen's own application to get there. So you'd have to reverse engineer the formulas that are in Immunogen's own patent application in order to figure out if such a person exists. And on top of it, I mean, the point at the end of the day is Lutz or no other reference teaches dosing based upon a person's height.
Are your claims limited dosing based on actual idealized body weight, or if it just turns out that the dose is the same, but nobody even considered the actual idealized body weight, are your claims still satisfied?
Our claims are specified to the specific amount of drug that is calculated that specific way.
It has to be calculated that specific way?
Well, the number has to be the same. So the question then is, okay, how do you find that? Could someone by happen chance randomly come to the same amount of drug? Perhaps. But then that would be infringement under because there's no requirement that you know that you're infringing. But the point being is simply because it by happenstance somebody might possibly infringe by accident doesn't somehow render your claim obvious. That it certainly can't be. There's been no discussion anywhere that the formula of AIBW that's found within the patent application, it was used by anyone with regard to an ADC. So finally, if I have one more minute, turning to the question of indefiniteness, the office keeps saying, look, the definitional section somehow says, you know, you can use other things. That's not at all what the definitional section says. All it does is say that ADC, adjusted ideal body weight, might refer to a size descriptor that accounts for sex, total body weight, and height. When later on actually using AIBW in order to dose mirvetuximab, it uses one formula only. We have throughout represented there is but one formula. The public is on notice of it. And we cannot amend now. So therefore, we should all know exactly what is required by this court's case law.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.